we have a culture in Shadowfax. When we fail, we party more than versus when we succeed.
A very unique culture of, but I think it starts with the top. If the founder is admitting to failures and mistakes, I can see how that culture resonates. So that's superb.
The first moment came in end of 2015. I think I met one of my founder friends who was a mentor and investor as well. He said, Abhishek, you have raised 50 crores. Agar tumne 50 crore raise karke band kar diya business, kya muh dikhaoge apne papa ko jaakar?
But most people would be pretty worried about potential failures.
So that sort of shook me quite hard.
Welcome to Unstarted. What is unique about this show is this is about you. It is for founders, by founders. I am very excited to have our first public company CEO on the show today. But like we have promised, not just, you know, all the glory that looks from the outside, somebody who's also willing to talk about multiple near-death experiences along the way. He's now a $1 billion market cap company CEO, and the stock ran up in exactly 1 month since he confirmed to be on this podcast. So with that, Abhishek Bansal, welcome. Very happy to have you here. CEO, founder CEO of Shadowfax. It's amazing to see the journey from the day, when did you graduate?
2012.
From graduating to going public about 13 years, 14 years. Amazing, yeah. Amazing. I think it's the stuff made of dreams, but I think the part of it that when we were prepping that I thought was most interesting was how open you are about talking about the fact that this is not a linear journey and up and to the right. So again, thank you for doing this.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me here, Amnish.
So going all the way back, let's go back, you know, many of in the audience will be seeing Shadowfax as a listed company, saw you ringing the bell at NSE. Maybe hard for them to relate, but I know that the background is actually very relatable for most people. So born and raised where? What is the family background?
Yeah.
How did you end up becoming an entrepreneur?
So I'm 35 now. I was born in a city of Meerut. It's near Delhi.
Yeah.
Studied and born and brought up over there. My parents were middle class businessmen. Mother is a housewife. So came in a very modest sort of a household. Extremely focused on studies because, I mean, generally like that's how Indian middle class is very, very aspirational. I think that's what my parents were. They wanted me to see and do something unique. Back in 2008, cracked IIT JEE, went to IIT Delhi, did production industrial engineering. It was a big step even then. Post that, joined my first job, was working in a consulting firm for a couple of years. And then somehow something happened. I mean, in 2014, I realized that probably this is not exciting enough for me. And even if I probably lose a couple of years trying something different, trying something unique, it won't matter in the long term. And hence I took a leap in 2014.
Let's pause there because that's not a very easy call. Yeah. Most people would be very worried about, thank you. Most people would be pretty worried about potential failures. And IIT, and you said your parents actually wanted you to do something different. How do you think about that? Did you think about what you said? It wouldn't matter, but it would matter. No, you would fall behind your peers. They would all get ahead.
I think, see, the journey of an entrepreneur and the founder, I think you don't honestly think a lot about what can go wrong. And it's a common mistake everybody does. I think back in the day, we were just barely 24. I don't think we were looking back. I don't think in our journey we ever thought if this does not work, what will happen? All we were thinking is like, we don't have any other option than to succeed. So I think that's what drove us forward. Even I think in our subsequent fundraisers, how we raised capital, how all of that happened. I think if we were sane enough to know what can go wrong, I don't think we would have done it.
Very good. So too much sanity too early is also not a good thing. Yeah. So that fearlessness really drove you. Parents sounded like they were supportive, sounded like failure was not an option.
No, parents actually didn't know that I was starting something. They thought I'm still working in my job.
Probably the third or fourth entrepreneur who's told me this. So I don't know if that's a takeaway.
I mean, it's tough. I mean, honestly, if you're coming from a middle class, you say you have a great job and suddenly you decide to do a job for an idea where you don't even have your own capital. So I think this is something which was hard to digest for the family. I honestly didn't even try to explain. I was like, okay, let me raise some capital, because without capital anyways, I'll have to go back and do something else. So I think it was only until we had got some view on capital coming in is what our family actually knew that, okay, these guys don't have a job.
Interesting. Superb. How did you think of what to start? Lot of times people say, yaar, mereko karna hai par idea nahi hai.
Yeah, I think, again, it would sound really stupid, but it came out from a
$1 billion outcome doesn't sound stupid anymore.
No, we just felt that there was a problem we were facing personally. We thought it is a problem which every individual, every upcoming individual in this country is going to face. And the problem was very, very simple. At 8 o'clock in the night, if I my cook coming in, I don't want to go out there and buy vegetables. I don't want to go out there and do anything. Why can't there be a simple ecosystem which delivers to my doorstep? This might sound so stupid now in the times where we are in, where we are fighting for minutes of delivery. But back in the day, nothing existed. This is 2014 I'm talking about. Food delivery, Swiggy started in 2015. All of this, all like the first set of companies which were delivering what we call as hyperlocal actually started in 2015. So I think back in the day, it was just a dream that, okay, it came out from a personal problem that we were living in Gurgaon back then. We thought it's very, very difficult to actually go out and shop for anything. It's cumbersome. It's something which is redundant, which nobody needs to do. So it came out from a personal problem. I had before that spent a couple of years in China, where I was working with one of the largest retail companies over there. And we were actually solving this O2O problem for them. And China was at least a decade ahead of India. So we saw this entire revolution
happening. And O2O was offline to online.
Offline to online. So we saw this entire challenge happening over there. We're like, okay, we come back to India. Why are we still living in a third world? Why does something like this does not exist? That is how we started.
Very good. I want to pause you there. So you said delivery to the doorstep. Delivery to the doorstep did exist with Amazon and Flipkart, but you meant local
more
delivery.
Local. Instant
gratification. You had seen it work in China.
Yeah.
And that gap existed in India.
Second thing, what we realized was that specifically from a supply chain, it's just a supply chain problem at the end of the day. What we also realized back in the day was that nobody was trying to crowdsource it. Everybody was trying to go the traditional employee-driven sort of an approach. And 2014, 2015 is the time when we saw the Olas and the Ubers of the world do some crazy stuff using crowdsourcing technology. So we thought it's a great time because now the technology exists. We can create a similar sort of an ecosystem in a more B2B universe, offer this sort of a crowdsourcing last mile service to probably everyone out there. I still remember we used to call it last mile capacity over a cloud, like how payments are accessible. Why can't last mile capacity exist in a very similar sort of a framework? So that's how we started.
And I remember that pitch. We have promised people we'll take questions. So I remember your pitch was very good. So the question is about what to look for in a VC, but there are many stories around that. So we'll look at it.
My question is, when you have multiple offers from different venture firms, what is the one quality or a couple of qualities you're looking for to make that decision? What pushes you towards one VC towards the other?
So let's back up. You have decided to start, you have found a gap in the market. You did say you didn't tell your parents. You followed more of what I would say a potentially repeatable path for people, which is have an idea, look for funding. But you were also 2 years out of college. So talk about that story. Right. How did you manage to get VCs interested, and then why did you pick the wrong one? No, I'm kidding.
So, no, that's a good question. I'll come to that in a bit. But I think our journey was, so I'd left my job in 2014, spent the next 12 months figuring it out, how to start, how to get the team together, convincing Webhav to come in. Webhav was 2 years junior to me. The day he came in, we actually started that day.
Pause there. I want to go deeper because there's a question that comes a lot about co-founder. Should you have a co-founder? So you were clear you needed one, and why?
Yeah. I was very, very clear. And again, different people have different choices in deciding for a co-founder. Today, we are a group of 4 co-founders. All of us, we were together, dorm mates at IIT Delhi. So we knew each other for a fair bit of time. See, entrepreneurship is a long, painful journey. It's not a short journey. I think for me, the biggest benefit of having four of us together is that even when chips are down for two of us, I think the remaining two hold the flag and keep the spirits really, really high. It is such a lonely journey that doing it alone is extremely painful, extremely cumbersome. So if you have a choice, if you know somebody, you should get them in. Again, you should not force fit it. Force fitting also does not work when you are looking for a co-founder. It's like force fitting and getting into a wrong marriage. So, but having a companion for the rest of your life always helps.
But this is very important. When people ask me, I often, you know, there's a lot of discussion around complementarity of skill sets. When I ask people this question, many of them think about that and they talk about that, but after the decision has been made. And the decision is actually made on the emotion of it, which is you need a companion. It's lonely at the top. It's a very long journey. So you thought about it like that. How did you pick Vaibhav?
I think with Vaibhav, I think the conversation was very different. I was not a techie. And I realized that what we are trying to build is extremely high on tech. Vaibhav was 2 years junior from my same hostel. So, and he was the smartest person I knew at that time. He knew about coding. He was an electrical engineer, but he understood, I think, the computer science fundamentals pretty well. He was, again, as I said, one of the smartest people I've met in my life. So it was a no-brainer for me to get him in.
Okay, superb. So let's go back to the story. Yeah, so now you've gotten the co-founder.
So now I think it's me and Vaibhav. Vaibhav is like 22, I'm 24, and we have a great idea. And we are not thinking if we'll fail, what will happen. Our pitch is all about that we are building a $1 billion company in the next few years. So we go to, I still remember, we directly went to VCs. We didn't go to anyone.
But why go to VCs? Why not start the business, bootstrap? Many people think of it like that.
Okay, we didn't know there's an option to bootstrap. Okay, we...
पैसे भी तो नहीं होंगे ना
पैसे भी नहीं थे तो बट ड्रीम था ना सो वी आर लाइक वी हैव अ बिग ड्रीम वी विल नॉट थिंक स्मॉल इन आवर जर्नी ओके सो माय जर्नी इज अबाउट नेवर थिंक स्मॉल
दैट्स द की सो यू आर पिकिंग अ बिजनेस दैट वुड रिक्वायर वेंचर कैपिटल
दैट विल रिक्वायर वेंचर कैपिटल सो आई वाज नेवर थिंकिंग दैट ओके दिस विल रिक्वायर लेस कैपिटल व्हाई डोंट वी डू समथिंग एल्स सो फ्रॉम डे जीरो वी वेंट टू द बेस्ट वीसीज इन टाउन ओके And I still remember vividly, we were sitting at a VC's office and they're like, okay, this sounds great, but do something. You are a presentation right now. We are like, we don't have money. That's why we are here to ask money. But he's like, but if you don't even deliver a few orders, how can I put money?
Yeah.
We're like, okay, simple. You give us some money, we will try it out. So we went in around circle and circle for a week. Finally, that guy's called. He's like,
but you had quit your job.
We had quit our job.
So because no VC will put money, just so people know, if people have put your own life into
it. Oh, we had put...
Your savings and your life.
Life, savings, everything into it.
Yeah, okay? You're all in.
And we were asking for a lot of money on a presentation.
Yeah.
Okay. And
how much?
We were asking for $5 million.
Yeah.
Okay. On a presentation, we had no proof of concept at that time. We had extremely high conviction on our idea. So that VC, I still remember, I'm big, hugely thankful to him. He said, okay, how much do you need? I said, I can do, my question, how much do you need to put in money?
He said,
okay, do 500 orders a day.
Hmm.
I'm like, to do 500 orders a day, I need 8 lakh rupees.
Hmm.
He's like, that's it. I'm like, yes, that's it. He made a call to his friend, okay? He's like, I'm sending 2 kids to your, please sign.
8 lakhs.
He actually made 2 calls, so 4 lakhs each. We went to his office, and that guy is like, "Guy, mere 5 lakh rupees." I'm not joking. He looked at me, he's like, "Guy, I'm just doing this out of friendship." And we raised that money in.
But it is credit to the VC that he gave you, and I think it's very important for people to know. If a VC is saying no, often they are making up stories to say no. I think this thing of saying how much do you need to see? Some of the best in the world will tell you, this is what I need to see to invest. And that will also tell you whether they're making stories or whether it's the reality.
Yeah, so I think that happened and we went there, we signed a check. And so for the next 4 weeks after that, I think every weekend we would raise some 20, 30 lakh rupees. And we would spend that money in the next 6 days.
From friends and family.
From
and
friends,
angels.
Families, founders.
Hmm.
Okay.
Hmm.
The funny thing is, all those people that we raised in the first month, they are still our shareholders.
Wow.
They have not sold a penny yet.
What X must have they made? 1000X, whatever.
Maybe. And we needed that money. At that time, we didn't understand. We are like, we just need that money to survive to the next week because We have a few weeks of numbers to display without, and at that time we never thought, okay, what will happen the subsequent week? We have employed some people, what will we do? How will we, were just not thinking about it. We were like, this has to work.
Yeah.
So there was a very, very high degree of conviction, which people loved.
Yeah.
At the end of the fourth week, by that time, I think multiple VCs have started engaging with us, a lot of work was done by a bunch of VCs around it. So we got one offer at we got a $2 million offer from one VC, we got a $5 million offer, and we got a $9 million.
We gave you the $5 million offer, but the other VC gave a higher offer.
So, and it just happened in a month sort of a period, faster execution. We raised more money. We launched like in about six cities in 6 months after that. And the journey started off Shutterfly.
So going back to the question.
Yeah.
I think you've kind of alluded to why you picked the way you picked, but how did you go about picking that VC? Why not the two? Why not the five? Why the nine?
Yeah.
Was it just money, the amount?
So I'll tell you something interesting. And it's, first of all, it's a great problem to have if you have multiple VCs talking to you. Thankfully, we have been lucky at a few junctures in our fundraise process across the last decade where we have seen that cycle. And I think looking back, I'll tell you, the most important factor, the most underrated factor rather, some people look at valuation, some people look at brand. I'll tell you what, if going back in time, what we thought we did the right decision as well, but and which is probably the most honest answer to this, is look for people who have conviction. Okay? It is very, very important to have people around you who have done enough diligence, who believe in your market, who believe in your idea, probably even more than what you do. Because when things will go bad, at that time, those are the funds, those are the people who will continue backing you,
yeah,
rather than ones who have probably just come on some sort of a FOMO.
And which happens a lot, this FOMO visiting kind of money in every cycle. There's a lot chasing it, and it's at higher prices.
At higher prices. So I think, how do you ensure that you don't take that?
Yeah.
You take the one where you know that that fund has done enough work for you, that they'll stay by your side. I think that's been the primary parameter, I would say, in our learning that, and that's what I advise even young founders who talk to me who have these multiple offers. I'm like, okay, simple. Who has done the most amount of work? Who was the first one to actually give you an offer? Who was the first one to make a move? Because making that move, and you will know that, right? Making that first move from a VC
is independent conviction.
Is independent conviction. It's very tough to.
And something else you said sounds like a very classy first VC you met who actually already helped you without putting in the money by getting you money from others.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so that was a fantastic
one. Yeah. Superb. This all sounds great, but you talk a lot about near death and failures and all that. So let's take the next question and then tell us what is not so great in the story. And I know we'll play some role in that.
Hey, myself, Saral Namdev. I am basically working as a developer, as a developer. I am an aspiring entrepreneur. And I want to understand that when failures happen, how do founders bounce back?
So which year are we in now? The money has been raised?
I'm in 2015.
2015. Let's move forward from there. How long was it an exciting phase? What was happening? And then when did the roadblocks happen and why?
Yeah, it didn't last too long. I think 2015 we started, we raised money, the exuberance.
It was sort of bubbly environment. 2016 it blew up again.
End of 2015 it crashed.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
There were like some 4 or 5 companies like us who had raised good amount of capital in our sector alone.
Yeah.
I think fast forward to 2016, end of 2016, none of them survived.
Yeah.
Okay. Probably one or two of them were pivoting and they were trying to do something else. But to the idea what we were doing, I think it was only us who had survived. And we were the only surviving company from that group.
So, why?
That's a good question. I mean, we were just not willing to die. Simple. I mean, there was an insane amount of resilience, innovation, whatever you call it. We knew we had to crack it. We realized where we were doing wrong, where others were doing wrong. We went back to the basics of how do you run a business, how do you make money, how do you focus on unit economics, slow down.
So the bansal in you came out, huh? the dhanda came out. Because
I
remember during that phase, some of your peer set of such local logistics companies, they also got absorbed in the larger companies. They got bought out.
Yeah.
Did you have offers?
We had offers, but honestly, we were not looking for an exit path at that time. And I think one of the core reasons was we still had conviction on the idea.
And you had enough money and runway?
We had enough money and runway. We had cut down our burn severely. I mean, that's what you need to do at the end of the day. See, one thing we realize, and now looking back again, I mean, see, no business is always going to have a fun time. It is inevitable that you will always, you will have problems, you will have failures. There will be cycles in your business. It is something that one founder has to live with. Okay, you might start at a bad time, end in a good time, but I mean, things will always keep on happening especially in a country like India. So we figured out our runway, we pivoted our business model, we started doing what we do today, like end-to-end e-commerce sort of solutioning, where there are higher margins rather than just doing 30-minute gratification deliveries. So we did a lot of pivots, a lot of learnings that we understood. We pivoted our model from an SME base to a more enterprise base. Enterprises were willing to pay much higher, they were more structured, giving us scale everywhere.
All of this, because people will say, yeah, pivot. The fact that one is in a tough situation and one needs to pivot becomes clear at some point. But what to pivot into is never clear. What was the North Star in your pivots? Was it profits that we have to, the economics has to work?
See, now I can sit here and give you a lot of answers. But honestly, just to be honest on this group, I don't think we had any idea. We were just trying everything that we could have done and trying to learn and figure out. See, we were very, very young back then. Half of the business models that we execute today, we didn't even understand back in the day. You're just trying it out.
No, but that's very encouraging and very a lot of hope for people. You just kept at it and hustling.
Yeah, and I'll start with a few anecdotes in this.
Please.
Okay. So the first moment came in end of 2015. I think I met one of my founder friends who was a mentor and investor as well. He said something to me and it really hit me hard. Okay, he said, Abhishek, you have raised 50 crores. Agar tumne 50 crore raise karke band kar diya business, kya muh dikhaoge apne papa ko jaakar? 50 crores you were given and you shut down. Okay, you were, I'm like, okay, that
very
shook
good.
Me. Okay, so that sort of shook me quite hard. And we are like, okay, let's figure out.
This was a disinterested, this was not an investor, this was a friend.
A founder friend. I mean, he had put in some money in the company, but he didn't give advice.
He was giving you real advice.
He was giving me real advice. He's like, Abhishek, you can't do this. Okay,
yeah.
So okay, it shook me hard.
Yeah.
After that, we realized, okay, we were burning a lot of money. Business is growing, but we are burning money. We got through a company, which was one of our competitors, which was doing slightly different kind of logistics. They came to us, they had to shut down because they were left with no cash, we had more money. But we looked at their business model and we thought it can be made profitable in 1-2 quarters. What they were doing, we had no idea. They were doing reverse logistics, okay? The company called Pick and Go, huge credit to their founders for what they had built in the last few years. They were out of cash. Some of the founders actually joined us, taught us how to do reverse logistics. That's how our reverse logistics journey started. We acquired an asset, which we had honestly no idea getting into, but we wanted to try everything out at that time. Funnily, we are the market leaders in reverse logistics.
Wow.
Okay, so we built on that idea. We made it into a cash cow business.
Hey, but this is a very important learning. Believe it or not, in 2001 to when I was building Bazi, we survived because in the downturn, we managed to acquire our competitor.
Yeah.
Because we had more money.
Yeah.
It wasn't that we were better. But they had a great technology and it really helped our business.
So we got them in.
Thoda matlab opportunistic hona chahiye like.
So we are trying everything. So we figured out where can we make money. We thought this is a great idea. We can make money. Let's try it out. And we started building from there. So you will always have failures as an organization. I'll tell you, as a founder, there are 2-3 things one should be aware about. Okay. First is, you will always fail. It has to happen. Okay.
In the journey,
you will.
You just assume it'll happen.
The day you think you are failing, accept first of all you are failing. The biggest problem, and that's what I tell my team also at times. The biggest problem with a lot of us, which eventually happen, is that we get too much into solutioning without even understanding what the core problem is. Knowing the core problem is the hardest problem in life. Okay. So when you are failing, figure out what your problem is. Acknowledge that. Accept that to yourself. That is point number one. Second point, accept it in front of your team that you have failed. Every founder fails, every organization team fails, everyone fails at some point or the other. How you accept that in front of your team raises that spirit. Because the
but
moment
team to fir will give up, demotivated and leave.
Team, when you're failing, when things are failing, how you navigate through that, how motivated you are through that is a make or break. You can fail, but you can make an easy comeback by just being high spirited. Teams get disillusioned not by failure, but how you behave in that failure.
Excellent. Very good. Team also knows that it is failing, but if you're not acknowledging it, if you're not being authentic, they're more likely to leave than if you acknowledge it.
Yes, exactly.
And it probably brings you closer together.
Brings us closer. I'll tell you something. We have a culture in Shadowfax. When we fail, we party more than versus when we succeed. Simple. Raise the spirits. Be positive in that time.
Spirits, no pun intended. Was IPO day like that?
Oh, IPO day was, I mean...
So, stock ended up below below the listing. How? And any other anecdotes you want to talk about?
I think other than the listing price and all, I think it was a overwhelming sort of a day. Okay, when you see everyone that matters to you in that room. And especially, I mean, see, for us, honestly, listing is not an end goal or any. We have none of the team members, no founder, nobody has sold a penny in the IPO process. Okay, I think for us it is just a stepping path in a very very long sort of journey. We are just like barely 34, 35 right now across all the founders. Management is under 40, so I think we've still got at least a few decades to give to this organization. So for us it was just, okay, this is some place we have to reach, then I mean the journey begins after that. So, but it was very, very overwhelming. It is hard to explain how much it matters to the organization, how people get moved when they realize that, okay, this is not a startup anymore, this is, you're building an institution. So it's something which resonates. I mean, you still get goosebumps. I still get goosebumps even after 3 months being on that stage, giving that address to...
So the stock being down is a small aberration in the bigger picture of creating an institution, having so many people filling that room. It's still a milestone. It's a great milestone.
Yeah, that's how we made ourselves happy at the end of the day.
With the spirits. Any other near-death episodes to talk about?
Oh, yeah, we have multiple. I mean, see, we've been there for a decade. We have had these kind of death experiences, I think, at least 3 times in our journey after raising capital, not before. Before that, it was every week.
This is what people should know, that even after raising, because you were in some ways a poster child in 2015, 2 years out of IIT, raising a lot of money, turning down people like us, and then where did it go?
So, I'll tell you, see, it is always easy to raise money in the first couple of years, because raising money on a story is easier than raising on data. Okay, so growth capital in this country is not easy to raise. You have to grow, you have to grow profitably, you have to gain market share, and you have to do all of these things the right way. People, because you have data to back it up now. So I think it's not an easy journey raising growth capital, and I think COVID happened. Post COVID, there was a slump in the market. So it was not easy to raise capital, and I still remember there was a moment where we were raising capital. Eventually the deal didn't go through. We had probably 2 months of cash left. Okay, I still remember it was a tough time for me as an individual. The same people who were there in my first sort of week, the same VC, they came together. They actually told me that this will work, don't worry. Okay, and I was so down, like I don't know how to come out of it. So I think they got me together. That was their first job, to be around me and gave me that comfort. The next thing I'm doing is I'm taking my team for an offsite, and we are making an announcement. Guys, congratulations. We are turning profitable in 3 months.
Wow.
Okay. I had no idea how, but we announced. We became profitable in 3 months.
So this is a pattern. You acknowledge your failures publicly with your team and you celebrate, and therefore you rally. So that's a very, very unusual culture. You must have a very, I would think, low attrition.
Very, very low attrition. So we are, like, if I look at my CXO layer and my founding layer, the top 10 people, I think average tenure with the company is 6 years. We are a 10-year-old company. In my top 40 people, our average tenure would be north of 4.5 years. So it's a fairly stable, steady setup. Simple, just be honest. no corporate gyan, no passing the blame on anyone. You do something, raise your hand, I did wrong. Okay. Nobody's saying anything to you. He has accepted his mistake. Let's move on.
Very, very good. Very, very good. This very unique culture of, but I think it starts with the top. If the founder is admitting to failures and mistakes, I can see how that culture resonates. So that's superb. Let's take the next question. So you've been through ups and downs. It's from Kush Sambal. He's a prolific question answer asker. So sustainable growth. How should early stage founders approach sustainable growth versus aggressive scaling, valuation? So huge valuation led to profitability led markets. Markets keep changing. The, you know, sometimes the money is cheap, they are valuing growth, sometimes profitability. You have over 10, 12 years gone through various cycles. What's the North Star with hindsight? What is the advice to people as they are navigating this constantly? Growth, profitability.
I think, see, when you're early in your journey, especially for me, if you ask my advice, I don't know if it's right or wrong, I'm a big, big fan of aggressive scaling. See, in a country like India, no idea is unique. Execution and scaling fast gets you out of the pack.
Yeah.
Small outcomes don't excite anyone. Period.
Yeah.
So the first check is whether as a team, as an idea, can you show that you can scale up fast? Now, when I mean scale up fast, I'm not talking about bad revenue and revenue management. Again, that's not what I'm suggesting. But at the end of the day, if you have a core idea, you have to scale as quickly as possible. You will do it by doing some mistakes. In your early stage, don't imagine things to be perfect. Don't imagine, there will be mistakes. If you continue perfecting your idea in a shell, you will never be able to grow beyond a point of time because life is never going to be perfect. Are we perfect now? No, we're still doing mistakes.
But you know, there is something, because I observed this right from the time you started the company. You wanted to create a large outcome. You basically raised VC money because you wanted to create a large outcome. You followed into a market that was a large outcome. And so I think to this point, if you switched that, that would not be authentic to you if you became profitability focused. Now, as a VC, I might have to shoot myself at some point, but I do say, you know, even Kirana stores are profitable, but scale nahi hai.
Scale nahi hai. So I think it's, see, again, there's no right answer to honestly this question. There are different kind of solutions. So some are high EBITDA solutions, some are low EBITDA steady state solutions. For a high EBITDA solution, you can definitely scale really fast. Boards will be okay with that because eventually you will make money at scale. For a low EBITDA margin business, you'll have to scale, become efficient, scale, then become efficient. Yeah. So different markets will have different, there's no straight answer to this problem statement, but at every moment of time, you need to think scale first.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you are not, somebody else will do it.
Somebody else will do it. And I would say, but if you were to say, what are the guardrails around that? One is unit economics. Unit economics, well, like you said, it can't be bad revenue or fake revenue. So unit economics should be working. And you have to figure out a way to keep your business financed.
Yes.
And you, in that, you went through some ups and downs, but wo karna hi hai.
Okay. So see, if you have capital, you can figure out, okay, this is the amount of runway I always need to happen. With that, keep in mind, you continue scaling. As you realize you have scaled a certain, take a step back, fix on the unit economics, fix on your profitability, raise more money, then again pump back. So it's a cyclical sort of a thing. You cannot endlessly just raise and spend. Because efficiency will not get built. The blocks of efficiency won't get built if you continue just doing that. Think about it, like, let's say you're building a product pipeline. Maybe you should always have 50% of your pipeline for growth, giving a very, very raw answer. 30% always towards unit economics, 20% maybe experiments.
It's a great way to think of it. It's a great thumb rule. With that, you decided to go public. Markets don't reward aggressive scaling and volatility in profits. Congratulations, your stock is up. You're now a $1 billion company, probably 40-50%. So clearly you have delivered. How did you balance this? And did you always think that you wanted to be a public company CEO? Was that an aspiration?
Again, back in the day when we were starting, I think we were thinking we'll probably be doing this much faster. I think 10 years is too late for us. We always think like that. We always think how quickly can we execute. See, for us, it is, see, public, again, as I'm saying, being listed honestly does not change our life at all, okay? While obviously we are well capitalized now, we have a much, much long-term sort of a view.
You're personally well capitalized also.
No, I have not taken any exit in the IPO. So, so I think we are exactly we are hungry enough to look for much, much more for the next decade or so. I think going public is a sort of a thing which gives cumulative happiness to everyone around you. Okay, for employees it gives great recognition. For families who have sacrificed their lives equally with us, I think it's a great thing that okay, now there is a publicly listed company. It means a lot, especially I mean, in my family, I don't know anybody who has taken a company public, so it means a lot for us as a family. But I think more than that, for a business like ours, I think the true business benefit for us is, see, when your customers are working with you,
yeah,
in a B2B ecosystem,
yeah,
them working with a listed company versus working with an unlisted company means the world to them. Okay,
yeah.
You are giving a very, very important part of your business, which is logistics, to an external entity. You're outsourcing something which is very, very core to your own business. You get doubly sure the moment you realize that these are sustainable.
I think that's a very important takeaway. In enterprise or B2B businesses, that credibility,
yes,
and so this can actually compound for you, because your credibility goes up and then you can do even better,
yeah,
more business.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the situation is that we don't spend on marketing. We don't have marketing budgets as a B2B company.
IPO mein ho gaya marketing.
IPO is become like, it's taken us probably to every shareholder, every household. And as we continue, I think, building in the public ecosystem, we feel there's going to be a lot of business benefits to us. Just being there, out there, and doing business in a responsible manner.
Amazing. You know, when in my erstwhile Goldman Sachs banking days, we used to pitch companies for IPO, saying IPO is your best marketing event. And you've just given an example of why. Switching gears, world of AI. You are in as real world of business as they come, moving things around. Does the world of AI change your world at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the most game-changing technology we have seen after WhatsApp in running businesses, in doing anything. I think it is just changing the way tech companies like us are today working. I'll give you a very, very simple example, and then I can go into more complex ones. As a CEO of a company, I think until a year back, I used to look at presentations and people would come and do presentations. Today, our team meetings are where people come with a prompt, okay? People come with a prompt. The prompt says an answer, and in the team meeting, half of the time we are just discussing with the prompt on what to do, because it has all the data, it has all the insights. So a lot of people sitting in that room, they don't. It's not like somebody is memorizing or giving an answer, or they have to learn that data. It just changes. I mean, today at Shadowfax, our first level decision is being made by AI. As business leaders, we are all innovating post that.
What does that mean? Business decisions or routing decisions? Which decisions?
So routing, again, that all comes later.
Huh.
I mean, for example, today we have to create a CAPEX strategy. Okay, for the next 3 years, this is how a business is going to behave. How should our CAPEX strategy look like?
Yeah.
Now, our team actually created a financial model over Claude to plan that CAPEX strategy. What kind of configurations of machines do we need to put at what location? How is that going to evolve? What are the different IRR rates for every machine at every location? I think they came up with some 100 iterations, 100 combinations in that. When we looked at the data, I think we were all so amazed that it is physically impossible for a team of analysts to come to that level of output. Okay, so the first level output came from there, and then obviously we improvised on top,
yeah,
of that, putting real world assumptions, but the output was phenomenal.
That's what I'm actually putting it differently. With AI, historically low margin businesses or whatever margin should improve.
Margin,
right?
Should,
I mean,
improve.
Of course, the clouds of the world will take some of that margin away, but...
No, I think it's, honestly, we have evaluated that.
Yeah.
I think if you do it the right way, don't think like you can reduce a few people in.
Yeah.
I think the quality of outcome is,
yeah,
just becoming 5x better. The mistakes are reducing in,
yeah,
your work. The decision making, for me, I think it's decision making which changes the game for us.
Yeah.
I think the second thing which we have realizing across the organization is that coding is no more a threshold only for tech people. Everybody can code.
Everybody must code in some way at least. You don't have to, but some.
In our organization, I'll give you an example, and it's an extreme example I'm giving. A few weeks back, we called our HR team and they were giving me a lot of CVs because I had to do some shortlisting for one of my teams directly. They came up with some 200 CVs. I'm like, sorry, this can't work with me in AI. Give me something where I can use an AI tool. Our HR team created a tool on Claude through which I can easily shortlist CVs. They were able to tell me in which CV, like I can filter. Okay,
you can give your criteria.
I can give my criteria.
Yeah.
And our HR team built this.
Yeah.
These things, like when they built it, they were surprised how easy is it to build. They did not have to go to a third party tool or a SaaS platform or go to our own tech team to build something like this. Today in our organization, everybody is building something. Whatever like could have, can increase efficiency, can improve the quality of outcome, they're building tech for that.
Yeah.
So it just changes, it just creates a level playing field for everyone to really operate fast and build tech products much faster.
Superb. Abhishek, thank you for doing this superb story and journey. Anything we haven't covered, any advice you have to give people who are looking to start out? There are so many lessons I've learned just talking to you, especially the one about leading with failure, I'm going to call it. I think that's a fantastic lesson that it has actually brought your team much closer together. What else do you want to share?
I think, building an organization is not about an individual. It is about getting the team together. I think where we have been really, really lucky over the last decade is having probably my co-founders along with me, having my first set of founding team members. There are six more founding team members who joined back us in 2015, who are still there building with us. We have our management team which has been there for a while now. So as a leader, it is very, very important to attract the right kind of talent, and secondly, to keep them excited and retaining them over a long period of time. Because if you have people leaving you, honestly, I mean, the lower organization does not build itself into an institution.
It doesn't compound.
It doesn't compound, yes.
Superb.
I think that's been our journey.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
On everything till date, and Godspeed to the next phase.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.